Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth every Tuesday at noon on KVSH 101.9 FM and on voiceofvashon.org at your convenience. I'm your host, Susan McCabe. March is Women's History Month, so today's focus is on women around the globe who are making history. One such woman is my guest today. She is Kirsten Garnier, founder and CEO of Kati Collective, a small global consultancy firm that focuses on improving the lives of women and girls with collaborative action and tools to succeed. Welcome, Kirsten.
Hi, Susan. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. You know, one of the things that I used to promote your appearance today was the combination of women, technology, and partnerships. How does Kati Collective help women in that way, and how does that look on the ground?
Sure. That's a great question. And really, that trifecta, if you will, came from all of the experience of different jobs and positions I'd had previous to developing Kati, and really looking at the things that I was both most passionate about, but also felt like were the tools that could best be leveraged to actually impact and change the lives of women around the world. So the way that it comes together in my work is we primarily are focused on health issues. That's been a lot of what my background has been. We do get into other areas of development as well. But really putting kind of the woman or even the adolescent girl that many of these programs are trying to serve at the center of everything that we do, and thinking how does this impact her life? How do we bring their voices actually into our work, which is a lot of what we do? But then using tools like digital, and in the health world, it means getting digital tools out to frontline health workers, using mobile phones as a way to get health information to women and girls about how best to care for themselves. But then also looking at partnerships, and the global health and development community is kind of a very complex one that's made up of big international players like the Gates Foundation, the World Health Organization, Gavi, which is a vaccine alliance, and others, UNICEF and others. But then that all kind of trickles down to the priorities that governments set for the health of their people, and then the ways in which programs actually get implemented. So we do a lot of facilitating of those partnerships that really go across all the different levels.
So tell us from the perspective of one of the women or girls mm-hmm. you might have helped, what exactly did you create that helped to improve their lives?
Sure. So in previous work that I've done, I think is probably the most tangible, doing the consulting work.
Yeah.
We're less like at the actual level of the person on the ground. But in previous work, I was the global director of an organization called MAMA, which was out of the UN Foundation. And we had a model where we used mobile phones to send messages that were both locally relevant, but also timed to the stage of a woman's pregnancy and the age of her child, so that she would get weekly messages on her mobile phone, no matter where she was. And we were in four countries around the world: South Africa, Nigeria, India, and Bangladesh. And she would get a tailored message of the time she was in her pregnancy, letting her know how she could best be caring for herself at that time, where and how she should be receiving care at that time, and how to advocate for the needs of her child in her particular health system.
Wow. So South Africa, mm-hmm. Bangladesh, what were the other two?
India and Nigeria for that particular program.
So, all right, let's fast forward to
sure.
today and Kati Collective. So
great.
Are you still working in those four countries?
I work in a variety of countries now. A lot of the work that we do is actually what would be considered global. So, for example, we're working with many of the major global players in the immunization and vaccine delivery ecosystem. And so what we're doing is helping with developing some of the global frameworks around getting and using data for better immunization programs, but at a global level, which then trickles to the country levels. I am doing some other work specifically with a part of the World Bank called the Global Financing Facility, and I focus on Tanzania, Malawi, and Nigeria in that work. So there are times when I am working with specific countries beyond the global work.
So in each of those countries, you mentioned vaccine. Mm-hmm. Are you involved with distributing the COVID vaccine in those countries?
Not actually distributing of the vaccines. What we've been working on actually started pre-COVID, but is very relevant now in COVID more so than ever. So there's a new kind of global framework for the immunization world called Immunization Agenda 2030, and it's to meet the immunization goals, which would now include the COVID vaccination goals globally. But there's a lot of moving parts to that with, you know, global players like Gates and Gavi and the WHO and UNICEF, who all have to agree both on what needs to happen, but then how best to resource that. And so we've been focused on a part called the data strategy, which is looking at how does actual data get used to better inform the ways in which vaccines get distributed, used, reported on, all of those kinds of things. So it's a little bit wonky, but it's it does have to do with COVID, but it's not directly related to distribution of the vaccines themselves.
Wow. What are you learning as an individual about each of those cultures as you go through these processes of how do cultural norms impact distribution? How do cultural norms impact people's ideas about immunization? And what do you have to do to pull all those pieces together?
Yeah, it's complicated. And actually drawing on the MAMA work that I was just talking about, that was all what's kind of in the health world called behavior change communication. And that's what immunization is really about, too, is addressing what the cultural norms and beliefs are from place to place about why somebody would or wouldn't get vaccinated. It has everything to do with the trust that they have in their government and their government's health system. We're seeing that here in our own country.
Yeah.
And it plays out in different ways and for different reasons across different regions and countries. It also, you know, many people now, there are many places where there's migrant populations, which we're only seeing more of during, you know, as climate change accelerates.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you make sure that the specific, you know, norms and beliefs of a migrant population are addressed, and how do you reach them to vaccinate them? Again, it's all just a very complex kind of cascading ecosystem of a lot of different players who are addressing these things on the global and local levels.
So give me an example. Tell me a story about how the culture has impacted your work. Tell me a story about how it worked in Bangladesh as opposed to maybe how it worked in Africa.
So that's a good question. Again, I'll kind of draw on my MAMA work for that. So we would look and see from country to country what was impacting the maternal and infant death rates in those particular countries and say, what are the cultural norms? So in some places, like in Nigeria, for example, women would get in for three of their antenatal checks, but would often not go in for the fourth and would not have an assisted birth at the health facility. They would use what's called a traditional birth attendant, which was often somebody in their own village who was likely not medically trained. And that had a big impact on their maternal mortality rates. And so we really needed to target our messages around what some of those cultural beliefs and norms were around why women weren't going in for those final checks. And part of it was, frankly, their husbands did not want them being seen by what was often a male provider at that point then at, you know, the time of birth. And so they wanted them to be at home with a traditional birth attendant from their village. So that was one example from Nigeria that we saw.
How do you get around that? Or
well,
did you?
Well, I mean, it's an ongoing question. And it really was working with local people. And this is part of, you know, the deep belief I have with the company that I started was, how do we make sure that those local partners and local voices are involved in everything that we do? And so in that case, it was very much making sure that, you know, there were country teams that had local knowledge that could really get down to the heart of what those things were about and craft the messages in a way that made sense locally, even though we were kind of using a global framework or model for that.
So the global framework, I'm guessing, would be the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And then the communication has to be customized to the individual, to the culture yeah. that you're working in.
So in that case, for example, the global framework was a set of messages that addressed key issues at every week during pregnancy and the first year of development in a child's life. And there were, we had content that was approved by the WHO. And then from there, the local teams would actually then look at what were the cultural issues that were impacting those things and how could they present the information in a culturally relevant way. So the global framework was just science fact-based information. And then the localization was really what were the local issues and ways to communicate that could really help get that information out in a way that could be, you know, could be implemented for people.
Where have you had the most success? Where, of what particular project are you the most proud?
Well, that's hard to say. I'm proud of different projects for different reasons. I'm certainly incredibly proud of the MAMA work. But right now, there's two things we're working on within Kati that I'm really proud of and interested to see where they go. One that I want to make sure I mention is we're working with Seattle-based Malaria No More, which is a malaria advocacy and communications organization working to fight malaria and basically eradicate malaria.
Is malaria a problem in Seattle?
It's not in Seattle.
Okay, glad to hear that.
That's a good question. Okay. They are Seattle-based, okay. and they work to eradicate malaria globally. And we are not a malaria-endemic place, thankfully. But many places are, especially in Southeast Asia and Africa, and also some of Latin America. But they came to us about a year ago and said, you know, we feel like if we take a gendered lens, look at how malaria impacts women and girls, we feel like we could accelerate the fight against malaria. So we started doing a strategy for them. It's really now morphed into over a year's worth of work where we did start to see that, like, there looks like there could be a case made for this, but there's not enough research. We don't know enough. We started interviewing people in the health and malaria community, and also people in the gender and the gender justice communities. And they typically don't talk to each other, and started kind of bringing that information together. Then we facilitated a series of workshops around some of the key thematic areas that we found from those interviews, which were adolescent girls, cultural and systemic barriers to malaria, research barriers to malaria and what the research gaps were. And then we really looked at economics and economic empowerment for women and girls and around malaria. And then finally had a large leadership forum on this all. But really what it's come down to is we're now kind of helping to build a whole global ecosystem around bringing a gendered lens to the fight against malaria. And what we're finding is women and girls don't get malaria more than men, but they are exponentially impacted because they end up being the caregivers. And in malaria endemic areas, malaria is a way of life. People get sick all the time from malaria. And it's the women and girls that are caring for them, dropping out of school to care for others. Also, we're finding that the economic impacts could be positive for women and girls. We try to cultivate them as leaders in the fight against malaria, frontline health workers. There's something called vector control, where they go from house to house and spray for malaria. And men used to do those jobs. There's some groups now that are using women, and they're finding women are more successful because when they go to a house, they're more likely to be let in by the woman of the house, because often the men aren't home.
Right.
So there's all of these knock-on effects. It's getting us deep into how research is really kind of stacked against women. How research is stacked against women. And we're looking at, can we get more malaria research that actually calls for women being involved in the research and really cultivates women as researchers and scientists? And are there ways that we can get this published that doesn't have the barriers of traditional research publication that's very male dominated? And it's hard for women to get their research published. So that was a very quick overview of what's become this very multifaceted piece of work about gender and malaria, and really looking at, are there ways that women and girls can be more empowered because they're involved in the fight against malaria? And what are the ways that they're more impacted by malaria? So that's one thing that we're pretty proud of.
Would Kati Collective be involved as deeply as to develop women and girls in their leadership roles in those countries?
Well, what we would do, and we already have started working with, you know, when we did these workshops, we actually made sure that we had those voices at the table. We had a young woman from Nigeria that was one of the major speakers in the leadership forum, but we are working with local partners in malaria endemic countries who already have networks of adolescent girls that they do work with. And so that is our model, is to really find those partners and support those partners in then kind of cultivating their networks in their own countries. They can do that better than we can.
You know, that sounds almost like a daunting investigative effort to have to find those partners in all of these large and disparate cultures and countries. What's your first step in that process?
Well, I have a pretty big network from all of the work that I've done. I'm a bit of a networker and kind of what I call dot connector. So we start with the people I know. And then we just kind of go from there. And one group introduces us to another. And that's kind of how our work evolves. And that's the model of our work. We have a very small core staff. There's 2.5 of us that are full time. And then I have a large network of people around the world who mostly women who have different skills and live in different places. And I bring them in as subcontractors for specific pieces of work. So it's all just kind of leveraging those global networks and bringing the right viewpoint in at the right time.
You're listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org and 101.9 FM KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm Susan McCabe, and I'm talking with Kirsten Garnier, who is the founder and CEO of Kati Collective, working with women and girls around the world, literally. When you are seeking out these local partnerships, local organizations to help you communicate with women and girls and with, I would presume, villages mm-hmm. in all these different cultures, who opposes you? What sort of obstacles do you run up against?
That's a good question. And I would say the obstacles are more kind of about the general work versus us specifically. But it really is, a lot of it is the old, what I would say, kind of colonial model of health and development, which is these kind of large international agencies coming into a country or a community and saying, we have this program for you. And that's one of the reasons why we try to work in a different way, which is to co-create our work with people in those communities, with the governments that are, you know, being impacted, and really we bring them along as partners in the work. So that's one thing that is, you know, part of what's informed the shift in our model from kind of a traditional development model. You know, I think it's hard to gain trust. It's hard for people to really feel like, you know, again, everything that I'm coming up with comes back to the colonial model of health and development and different aspects of that. And I think it's really having to bring to be partners with the people that you're working with and making sure that, you know, we might get paid by Gates or, you know, Gavi or one of these big international agencies. But when we work with them, we really work with them to design the approach to our work in a way that ensures that, you know, whatever country or whatever model they're wanting us to work with, that we're really bringing along the partners who are the ones whose work it ultimately needs to be.
That sounds hugely challenging. So you're getting the support somehow. Mm-hmm. You have convinced the Gates Foundation and Gavi that they should support the model that you're using. Tell me a story about one of your efforts in one of these countries that worked, and maybe you can give us a sense of start to finish. What was the challenge? What was the goal? Where did you start? And what did you have to go through to get there?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like our work never feels like it's finished. So it's hard to tell a start to finish story. Let's see here. Well, I'll tell you one of some work I was doing with the Global Financing Facility. And again, they're kind of they're housed at the World Bank, but they focused on reproductive, maternal, and child health funding. I was working with their team in Tanzania, and they were wanting to do a training to basically train their leaders in the ministry around how to use data to make better decisions about, you know, their health program. And they wanted us to train the higher level leaders who would then go out and train people around the country. And it, we really wanted to co-create this with the government. And so it ended up being a very iterative process. I created some curriculum for this. They took it and, you know, did what they did with it and sent it back to me. And, you know, they'd kind of ripped apart what I'd done and I did all that. And I was like, okay. But then I had to keep reminding myself that it was their curriculum, not mine.
Yeah, that's.
And really, you know, ended up going forward with their version of it. When I flew out to Tanzania to help with the training of the trainers, and I ended up kind of sitting at the back of a room for most of 5 days, really only being actively engaged for an hour or two of those 5 days. And that was hard for me. I had to just sit back and realize they're doing it. They're doing the training. They're doing it their way. And when they would ask me for my opinion or what I thought or what adjustments they needed to make, then I would step in and do it. But it was a very co-creative model and was a good check for myself around what it actually means to engage in that way and literally sit in the back of the room instead, you know, that, of taking the lead.
That harkens to me what we in the white American world are learning about our roots in white supremacy,
yeah,
and in white privilege, where it is time to step back and recognize that people of other cultures and other colors have great ideas,
yes,
all their own that work within their cultures. And we have so much to learn from them. You've had to step back,
yes,
from and that position.
I feel like the last many years of my career has been very stepped back. When I was at MAMA, I was very public facing. And that was a different time with a different model. And now when there's a need for somebody to speak, I try to find others who have a voice that's more representative of the actual on the ground work than my own voice. And, you know, I will point people to our website. My colleague, Brooke Cutler, just did a really lovely piece called something about the colonial hangover. It's a poignant piece that also has a little bit of humor, which is really how we work. We bring humor into most everything, but it really talks about that colonial aspect and what it means for us to step back. And she kind of ends it with saying, you know, so come pull up a chair and sit in our discomfort. You know.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of time for the United States to become more of an equal.
Mm-hmm.
Player in the global world,
yep.
And not try to dominate or force the U.S. opinion, yes, on others. And you are a warrior, or shall we say an ambassador.
Thank you.
In that work. So how did the Tanzanian situation work out? What did you
they
end up
ended
with?
Up, and frankly, that was actually, now I'm thinking about it, my last trip before COVID lockdown. and I have seen things from their team that they were actually able to roll out that training around the country. And they got most of it done before COVID lockdowns happened in their own country. And my understanding is that it was well received and it was a very successful rollout. But the government and the Ministry of Health really owned it. You know, and it was a nice kind of very visceral reminder of how we should be working.
What about when you talk about data collection? That sounds to me really complex.
Mm-hmm.
How are you finding these other governments in terms of the data that they collect? Are mm-hmm. they collecting data that is useful for the programs that you're trying to create?
The main point is that we want them to collect data that's useful for them to make the best decisions, not only, you know, down at the frontline health worker level around specific healthcare, but then as a government around health policies and programs that they implement. I will say, I think that what has really made what is inherently complex even more complex is this patchwork of international players, donors, international, you know, pr- program developers, all of those kinds of things that all come in with different agendas for what they want to invest in. And that alignment and harmonization across donors is actually part of some of what we're working on. That's a lot of the data strategy work that we're doing around the immunization agenda, is really getting these big global players to agree to how to harmonize their resources and their approaches, because it's making things so much more complicated and less effective for many of these governments.
Yeah. So how severe are these disparities?
One of the things that I like to kind of use to illustrate this point. So you can imagine there's a frontline health worker out in a facility, you know, in a country. So we'll say Tanzania again. And they've got, you know, different donors and different programs that want to give them a digital phone to help. So they've got the one that does the maternal health, then they've got the adolescent health one, then they have the nutrition one. And what happens is that this poor health worker can end up with like three different devices, mobile devices, with different programs on them that they're supposed to be inputting information. And since they're not all connected together and they probably aren't deployed across the entire country, they still have these big registers that most countries have that are paper registers, where everything has to be put in by hand. So now they're putting it into the digital platform as well as the paper platform, and they're way under resourced. They're just trying to like serve their patients, and they've got all this, and they might be collecting hundreds of data points. Because there was, you know, a program 5 years ago that wanted them to collect all of these, but then they never got taken out of the register. You know, it gets so complicated so quickly. And if we could just think about that frontline health worker and what do they need to do their job and what do they need to collect, and then what does the government need to make the best decisions about how to allocate their resources, you know, you could get this to a more kind of digestible level of data collection. But it's really created a major problem for these frontline health workers that are underpaid and, you know, wildly understaffed.
Well, and it sounds like there's a lot of waste going on.
Oh,
well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So you could convince the donors and the government to start with the healthline worker, which apparently is what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, you know, there has been much progress in the last couple of years on this front. It, again, it's very complicated. And so it's a lot of harmonization and coordination across these massive agencies. And it takes time, but they are working towards it. There's more kind of principles and frameworks in place that they're all starting to really try to adhere to. So to, you know, put a glimmer of hope on it, like the groundwork is being laid and there's momentum in that direction. But it's been, you know, it's a complicated ecosystem for sure.
So in the 1 minute that we have left, I'm going to ask you to oversimplify this whole thing. What is your goal at Kati Collective for the global health of women and girls in the areas where you're working?
Well, our goal would be to just help align the global kind of ecosystem with really focusing on what women and girls need by bringing their voices into all of the processes that involve them and what their healthcare needs are, and so that they can actually access healthcare that's relevant and timely and accessible for them.
And how do you see that impacting their particular cultures, their particular countries? What do you think that's going to do for them?
Well, I think that healthy women and girls are empowered women and girls, and they can be leaders, they can be, you know, educated, they can be whatever they want to be if they have their health.
Kirsten Garnier, thank you so much for joining us here on Real Talk today, and most of all for the work that you're doing.
Thanks.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to us here on Real Talk. Really appreciate your spending a half hour of your day with me, and I will be here every Tuesday at lunchtime or at your convenience at voiceofajon.org.
Thanks, Susan. That was